Whatever. As long as I'm here, I want to do some good. And I'm very happy to be able to continue. Most people at my age sort of get into a rocking chair and sit on the porch and say nothing. And it's a little hard to shut me up, I'm afraid. I'm too enthusiastic about the teachings that my guru brought. I'm going to be beginning. Now that's bad grammar. I'm going to begin by singing a song to you. Okay. Home is a green hill, home is a wind, blowing betrayal far, far away. Home is the knowledge, heaven is near, home's the end of the fray. Home is my heart, that home's where I am. Nothing can dim the light of my soul. Home is forever, home is today. Home's a heart that is whole. Often I dream that life is a play. Laughter forever and skies never gray. But when I'm silent, freed from all care, I discover my home's everywhere. Home is a green hill, home is the wind, blowing betrayal far, far away. Home is the knowledge, heaven is near, home's the end of the fray. I won't bother to apologize for singing so badly. I have an excuse. It's really very nice to be with you all today. And I would like to begin by reading one particular passage, which I suspect it contains a question that many people have had. A visitor, the master told us, asked me yesterday, who made God? Many ask that question. That is because they live in the realm of causation. Everything to their way of thinking must have a cause, since that is how everything happens in this world. God, however, is the supreme cause. He has no need of being caused or created. He is the very cause of causation. The truth is, nothing is really created anyway. The Spirit simply manifests the universe. Ultimately, nothing causes anything, for nothing in actuality is even happening. That is a very extraordinary and deep passage. And we're going to try to talk about it today, because it's so much the opposite of everything that we see around us. Nothing is really happening. How did God bring this universe into manifestation? He simply was everything. He's like the ocean. The ocean manifests waves, but those waves are temporary things. They're phenomena. The water, when it moves, begins to assume the shape of waves. But in truth, the waves are temporary, and what you'll find is that for every rising wave, there has to be a descending wave. For every crest, there has to be a trough. This is the nature of the universe. God created everything through the law of opposites. For every left, there has to be a right. For every up, there has to be a down. Nothing is really happening, but with everything, it has to cancel itself out. You can't have one wave so high that it changes the level of the ocean. The ocean level remains always the same. I know they told me when I went to Hawaii, I went to the island of Hawaii and to Suva. Suva, is that right? Oh, that's Fiji. I forget now. Hilo. Hilo. And when this huge tsunami occurred a few years ago, suddenly there was no water there, and they found all these clams and things, and people were out there rummaging around trying to pick up these clams. They didn't know that the water was being drawn out so that it could come in again even more forcefully. And all those people out there who were rummaging in the suddenly exposed sand, they were all drowned. We must realize that nothing changes except in order to prepare for a bigger change. And yet, nothing changes at all anyway. Everything is covered over with eternity. Let's try to think what this all really means to us. We are not men and women, grown people, little people, children, old men and women. We're none of these things. We are one thing only. I remember, because this was for me, a very intense search when I was young. At the age of 13, I was trying to think, what do I want in life? Well, I wanted truth. And I decided the truth, I might as well begin big. I might as well begin by trying to be an astronomer. And I tried to understand the universe and the vastness of it. It was inspiring until I realized that it really didn't matter to me whether there were 100 billion galaxies or one galaxy or just one little mud ball of this earth. I needed a truth that would change my life. And that truth didn't really matter to me. And so truth then became for me that aspect of reality which can affect me as a human being. So what do I want in life? And I realized what I wanted was inspiration and joy and a feeling of fulfillment. And as I thought that way, I began to realize that people have to be helped. And so I thought of social systems. And I thought of communism and socialism and this ism and that ism. And I came to the point of realizing that no ism is going to change people. They have to change from within themselves. I tried to think without God. I tried to think of a universe in which God could be eliminated. Why? Because I went to church. Church is the best way of turning people into atheists. I mean, you listen to the absurd explanations for what God is, and you think, well, that doesn't make any sense at all. And so I turned away from God, but I tried to turn toward truth, and you can't do the two simultaneously. But I did find this over a period of time. First of all, I thought, well, okay, so social systems won't change. Society won't change me. I must change myself. But how can I do that? I must find inspiration inside. So I began to think that maybe the arts are the way. And I was very different from my father. He always asked how. I always asked why. And that question, why, was what was leading me. And I finally came to the point of realizing that music won't do it beyond a certain point. Beauty won't do it beyond a certain point. If nothing else happened, I became tired. The most beautiful music can become tiring. It becomes an assault on my senses. And I realized that what I really needed was something more. Always, my questioning came back to this question of, there must be a God. How can there be anything if there is not some supreme reality that binds it all together? And so beyond science, beyond politics, beyond social systems, beyond the arts, beyond everything, I grew up in a wealthy home. And so that I was used to, and I realized it wasn't the answer. My father was an executive in Esso, which is, the present name is Exxon, which at that time was the biggest company in the world. So it's not that I was wealthy, but they had everything they wanted. And I thought, this is not what I want. I remember my dad, when I was 16, offering to get me a tuxedo. I said, Dad, don't bother, I'll never wear it. In fact, I'm never going to earn enough money to pay income tax. And he laughed, he thought I was being ridiculous, but it turned out to be true. Because at the age of 22, I became a disciple of Yogananda and gave up the search for money and gave up everything except the search for God. And to me, that has been very fulfilling. But how did I turn toward God? At the age of 16, I hadn't even thought of turning toward God. And yet somehow I knew that I didn't want anything that this world had to offer. And I remember one night, I had thought to be a playwright. And I think probably I was a playwright in some former life, because at the age of 9, I was already writing dialogue. And I remember at the age of 7, my parents corrected something that I wrote for school. They said, you use the word and too much. You know, children are, and this, and this, and this, and this. And I knew they were right. I didn't argue at all, because of course they were right. But I remember this sudden impulse within me that said, who are they to tell me how to write? At the age of 7, I knew it was ridiculous, and yet it was because I had this subconscious remembrance of having been a writer before, and I suppose a decent one of some sort. And I realized then gradually that what I wanted to give people was truth, and I didn't know truth. So what was there to give them? Shall I flood the world with my ignorance? And I decided, no, I have to give up writing. In the very name of what I want to give other people, I have to give up writing. And so I quit. And I gave up everything. And I still didn't know what I really wanted in life. And I remember one night, this was down in Charleston, South Carolina, and I took a long walk out into the night. And I asked myself this question, if there's a God, what must he be? Well, he can't be a he. What about all the women? He's got to be something between he and she. He's got to be you can't call it an it. What is he? And I thought, well, he has to be one thing above all. He has to be conscious. Otherwise, he's not God. If he's just a power that, like electricity or something, and what's the use of calling it God? He has to be not only conscious, but consciousness. And I remember thinking then, if that's true, my consciousness has to be a part of his consciousness. He must have brought us out of into existence out of his consciousness. And these were deep thoughts. I had never read Indian philosophy. I had studiously avoided reading about religion because to me it was all a bunch of nonsense. And I thought deeply about this. And I thought, well, then if I am a manifestation of his consciousness, then it must be true that the more I manifest of his consciousness, I had stood on the banks of the ocean down there in Charleston and watched the waves come in, and there were rocks there. And the wider the opening between the rocks, the more water could flow through. But the narrower the opening, the narrower, the smaller the flow of water. And then I realized that the more open I am to God, the more I find fulfillment. And if I got drunk, or if I was lazy or tired, or whatever it might be, then I was less aware. And so the goal of life had to be to become more aware. Now, drinking wasn't a problem of mine. I was rather young for it even to become a problem. But I remember one day, it was a very hot day, and I was walking in New York City. And I thought, well, let me just stop in at a bar and get a couple of beers to cool down. And I did. And I noticed that after drinking these beers, I didn't feel quite as clear-minded as before. I didn't have the full control over my body, you might say, as I had had before. And I thought then, drinking is not the answer because it reduces my consciousness. I must expand my consciousness. So I gave it up and never went back to it. And I had smoked also. And I had decided to become a hermit. And I thought, well, whoever heard of a hermit who smokes? I mean, where is he going to go to get cigarettes? And how is he going to buy them? So I thought, I've got to give this up. Well, that was a little harder. And I found that it was the easiest thing in the world, like Mark Twain said, easiest thing in the world to give up. He said, I've done it 1,000 times. And so I would give it up in the morning, and come lunchtime with my coffee after lunch, that cigarette always tasted so nice. And so I would find myself smoking again. But I came upon a wonderful truth, and it came out of me spontaneously. But I want to share it with you. I want you always to remember this. I never said I have failed. I always said I have not yet succeeded. And after a year of this up and down stuff, finally one day I said to a roommate of mine, well, I've quit smoking. He said, oh, I've heard that one before. I said, no, I mean it. The next morning I had not the slightest desire for a cigarette. Never have had since then. And you will find that if you can get away from these thoughts of blame, self-punishment, I'm a sinner. Yogananda said, a saint is a sinner who never gave up. Get away from sin consciousness. It's the worst sin is to call yourself a sinner. Why affirm that which you are not? You are a manifestation of this infinite. But these thoughts were still forming themselves in my mind, and I had the misfortune of being intellectual, and so I was coming at truth intellectually. Had I gone by the heart, I think I would have found my answers very quickly. But instead, I had to figure it all out. And I remember a roommate of mine in college saying to me, why do you think so much? But I had to figure it all out. I had to know what life was. I had to know why we're here. I had to know what the goal of it all is. And so I kept thinking. And this night, as I walked out into the night, I was thinking, then if God is consciousness, and if I am a part of that consciousness, and how could I be anything but a part of it? Then I must become more conscious. And I remember my decision that night. It may seem secondhand, not all that interesting, I don't know. To me, it was absolutely absorbing. I was so thrilled to realize there is a goal of life, and I'm going to dedicate my life to that goal. There can be no other goal. What's the point of getting rich? I'd seen people rich. They didn't have what they wanted. They weren't happy. I'd seen people having good jobs and all the things that people like, nice homes and everything. It didn't mean anything to me. And I thought then, this has to be the goal. Nothing, you will find that the only really happy people in this world, really in quotes, are those people who hope to attain something. But those who have found it, they're never happy. Never. They never have what they're looking for. Because the only thing everybody is looking for is in his own self. And so, to find, well, Howard Hughes, he was the wealthiest man in his day. And somebody was able to talk to him on the phone just a few days before, about a week before he died. He said, "Are you happy?" "No, I can't say I'm happy." He was the richest man in the world. He didn't have what he wanted. The only people who have what they think they want are those who are still climbing the mountain, thinking, "Now at last I've found it." And when you have it, it turns to dust. And every single thing you look for in this world turns to dust. It has no meaning in itself, whether it be love in a temporary way. Human love is nothing. Human love is basically self-love. To the extent that it is not, like a mother's love for her child, it is beautiful. But then that poor woman has to live long enough to see that child grow up and become, I don't know, but I look at my... No, there's more to life than all of that. And I came to realize that this is the goal of life. And if so, I'm going to give my life to it. And that's when I decided I would be a hermit. I didn't know what hermits do. I didn't know. I was wondering if I was going crazy. I mean, just think of it yourself. Here you're living in an American culture. I hadn't been born a Catholic. I didn't know about saints. My mother talked about them somewhat, but I remember she was talking about their miracles. And I said, "Come off it, Mother. This is nonsense." I didn't think anybody had ever known God. I didn't think anybody had ever sought God. And here suddenly I was realizing that this was the only thing I wanted. And I thought, am I going crazy? And I remember going upstate New York and trying to find peace of mind in the beauty of the countryside. That didn't give it to me. I could look at the rain, the colors of the sunlight in a raindrop, and I could say that's beautiful. I could see it. I could analyze it. I could perceive mentally, yes, it's beautiful. I couldn't feel it. I couldn't become one with it. I was like a motor working on one cylinder, and it just didn't work for me. And I remember my poor mother, she wanted so much for me to be a spiritual child. As her firstborn, she had many times prayed throughout her pregnancy, "God, this first child I give to thee." And yet here I was, I seemed to her to have completely rejected everything she had dreamed of for me. I didn't want that definition. But more and more, I was being pulled in that very direction. It was her blessing, I have to say, before I was born, that made all this happen. But in that desire for truth, I finally came upon some of the Indian scriptures, and I was absolutely thrilled to scriptures, that God is consciousness. Just what I had found in my thinking that night in Charleston. And that our job is to become one with that consciousness and to realize that we are manifestations of that consciousness. And two things that I loved about the Indian teachings. One was that they weren't personal. They didn't speak of one son of God or one this or one that. They said everybody is a part of that same truth. And another thing I loved about them was they said you must experience that truth yourself. And so that was all I knew about the Indian teachings, except that it said in the Bhagavad Gita, in the excerpt that I read there, that you must go to a solitary place and meditate on me. I didn't know what meditation was, but I decided that's how I must spend my life. The very day, God worked this out for me beautifully. You have to say that he did it. My father was sent to Egypt to be the director of oil exploration in Egypt. And what makes me think that it was obviously a sign of God was that Esau changed his mind afterwards. He knew where oil would be found. He said where it would be found. Mobile went in there later and did find oil just where he said it would be. But Esau decided not to go there. And they ended up sending him to France, and he found oil there too. But the thing is that his mission to Akita Cairo was basically a failure because they changed their minds. And so why did he go there? I think he went there because he had to be out of my way. I could not have gone through this tremendous change that it took if it had not been for the fact that he was not there to stop me. And the very day that I put my mother on the ship to go join him in Cairo, I went up to uptown New York and went into what was then known as Doubleday Duran Bookstore. And I found Autobiography of a Yogi. That book absolutely changed my mind. I read in there he was a vegetarian. All right, I would be a vegetarian. I read, in fact, it was funny because that night some friends of the family invited me over for dinner and they gave chicken a la king. Well, I just pushed the chicken off to one side and ate the rest and hoped that that compromise would work. The next day, another friend of the family invited me to dinner. They were all trying to take care of me because mother had left. And they gave me hamburger. Well, no hamburger for me. And they thoughtfully provided a date for me, but I had read that Yogananda was a monk. All right, I would be a monk. And so I sat as far away from this date of mine as I could. I just absolutely, my whole life was changed. After finishing the book, took the next bus across the country. I remember I went to my godfather, who was also an employee of Esso, and he wasn't in his office, thank God. He might have tried to stop me too. But I felt I ought to say goodbye. So I just left a note on his thing saying that I was leaving for California, where I hoped to meet a group of people who I felt would teach me what I wanted to know about God and about religion. And I took that next bus all the way across the country. I had two thoughts uppermost in my mind through that long journey, 4 days and four nights. One was I had to meet this man. I had never thought of being anybody's disciple. It's not that I was that arrogant that nobody could teach me. I just had never met anybody who knew what I wanted to know. And with Yogananda, I had. So I was eager to become his disciple. I was eager to become his follower and to find what I was looking for. And the other thought in my mind was, because I've always thought in terms of if this is good, everybody should know it. And so this thought in my mind was, this is so wonderful. I want everybody in the world to know about it. And I came to him with those two desires. And when he met me, you know, it's a strange thing. He said, I'm seeing you today, not because you've come from so far, but because Divine Mother told me to. Well, I had never thought of God as mother or father or anything. But it's interesting that he used that word, Divine Mother. Yes, he often thought of God as his Divine Mother. But with me, it was particularly interesting for this reason. In a very recent lifetime of mine, I was a king in Spain who wrote a lot of songs to the Divine Mother. And as in this life, I have written just over 400 pieces of music. So in that lifetime, too, I wrote just over 400 pieces of music. And they were all dedicated to God as the Divine Mother, as the Virgin Mary. And so this has been really my sort of special relationship with God. I had a very strange experience one time. I felt that the Divine Mother wanted me to go back to India. And just 2 weeks before I was to leave, my car threw a rod, and I realized I had to get rid of this clunker. And the question was, should I spend the money that I have now saved up to go to India? Should I spend part of it getting a used car? I realized I needed a car. I live in the mountains. I couldn't get around without one, not and do the kind of life I was living. And so I said, my common sense tells me that I must have a car. But Divine Mother, if you still want me to go, then you are going to have to reimburse me. Now that may seem like a strange way of praying, but that's the way I pray. I treat God as my friend. He is my friend. Why should I go pleading with him for anything? So I just put it to her. I said, my common sense tells me that I must get a car, but you've got to reimburse me if you still want me to go. So this was Friday night. And on Friday night, I put $1,000, $1,100 down on a good used car. The following Monday morning, this is really a miracle. I got a letter in the mail, and it enclosed a check for $1,000, made out to me personally, not to Ananda. And the accompanying letter said, use this as Divine Mother wants you to. How many people in America call God the Divine Mother? I really, whenever I think of that story, I can hardly keep from weeping. Because God is, he's real in our lives. He takes care of us. He watches over us. And to the extent that we include him in our lives, he includes us. Don't think that God is far away. Don't think that God is not aware of your most intimate thoughts. He is always there. And I've seen again and again and again in my life that he takes care of me when I ask him to. I never have to worry about anything. Everything works out right. If you give him a chance, I say in this country, which of all countries in the world is the most given to experimenting and trying out to see if a thing works or not. Try God. Try talking you instead of he or she. Try to feel that you have an inner conversation with him all the time, and you will find that he is with you. She is with you. And it doesn't matter what religion you follow. This is superficial. There is only one religion in the entire universe. Everything has come from that, and everything must go back to that. God didn't create anything because he simply was. There's nothing to be created because everything just is. We are his manifestations. And what are we manifestations of? This is something that is a little harder to understand. But you know, the great masters who have come into this world have come with different messages, but always geared to the needs of their times. So when Buddha came, he came to help people to understand that you don't find truth by going through complicated rituals and mantras and so on. You don't have to please the gods. You have to improve yourself. So he didn't talk about God. He said, what are you doing to improve yourself? Well, as always happens, people are basically stupid, and so they misunderstood him too. And they said, well, he's an atheist. It isn't that Buddha was an atheist. It's that he wanted to emphasize that we too have our part to play. We've got to do it. You can't let him do it all. And so after his death, Buddhists became atheists. And so Shankaracharya came, and he was sent with another mission. And that mission was that, yes, God exists, but he's not a form. He doesn't have four arms or 10 arms or all these weird images that symbology had created in India. God is simply Satchidananda, absolute existence, absolute bliss, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss. And I remember a dream I had. This was in Florence. I'd gone to see my publishers in Italy, and that night I stayed in a hotel. And in this dream, it was a wonderful experience for me because I saw all kinds of human beings, old men, young people, people soured in expression, people with happy expressions, criminals, rich men, poor men, many, many different kinds of people. And I said, every one of them is seeking that same bliss. Every one of them is seeking that is his own existence. And another wonderful thing about it is, Yogananda described it as ever new joy. Bliss is ever new. And every human being seeks it in his particular way. And I saw all these different people. All of them basically were seeking bliss. And all of them were seeking it in different ways. And I thought, how could I not love everybody in the world? Because all of them are seeking the same thing. We all just want bliss. It's hard to convey the full impact of a dream. And yet the fullest impact that came to me was that I have to love everybody in this world because we're all seeking the same bliss. And since then, I will see complete strangers in the streets. And if he looks unhappy, if a stranger looks unhappy, I'll try to, as Yogananda said, shoot him with the buckshot of your smiles. Try to make people feel happy. Complete strangers, it doesn't matter. Everybody is all seeking the same basic truth. It's very hard, I find, here in Los Angeles to make eye contact. It's strange, they're sort of afraid of each other. But I have to say that I won't go along with that gag. I just go up to complete strangers and say, how are you? And say something nice to them to make them feel happier. It makes life worthwhile. It's not that I go spending my whole time that way, but I do it deliberately because I find that so often people are touched that you would ask. People are moved that you would show interest in them. And yet, how could you not? They're all your brothers and sisters. Life is so wonderful when you see that underlying everything there is that bliss. This is why, and it's a truth, and you have to, if you examine yourself, there are two things that everybody in the world is looking for. One is, how do I get away from pain? And the other is, how do I find happiness? Everybody wants just that truth. This is the great truth that Yogananda taught in The Science of Religion, which I edited and changed, and because, as Zarif complained, I gave it the new title, God is for Everyone. But that basically is a re-editing of Master's book, The Science of Religion. And the reason I felt that it would need re-editing was that it wasn't Master who wrote that first book. He had the inspiration. He was on a trip to Japan as a young man, his first foray outside of India. And when he came back with this message. He didn't know English well enough to write it, and so he asked a friend of his, a disciple. But this disciple was very intellectual and very dry, and I know what dry intellectuality means, and I don't like it. I'd much rather be a little child loving God with all my heart. I have the answers. Yes, I do. But often I don't care to give them, because the real answer was contained in one time a very intellectual person who, oddly enough, took my name also, Kriyananda. I don't want to go into that because he's fairly well known. But he came to Yogananda with a long list of intellectual questions. And he expressed his first question. Master, out of the blue, just said, love God. The man shook his head and said, well, okay. And he asked his next intellectual question. Love God. Well, okay. Went on to his third intellectual question. Master said, love God. Got up and walked out, didn't say anything more. And this man has used this example to show that even saints have their problems. Well, the answer to it all is to love God, and he never understood. But we must realize that bliss is the answer, and love is simply bliss in action, bliss reaching out toward its own in someone else. That love, if you can see it, it becomes so wonderful that life is just you can't say it doesn't have meaning. It's the whole meaning of life when your heart is completely fulfilled, when you feel complete satisfaction in your heart. Then you know you've been born for a reason, and until then answers won't give them to you just mentally. I've been that route. I know it doesn't work. But to love God is the sweetest experience you can possibly have. When you feel that he is your own and that his bliss is all that matters in life. This is what everybody's looking for. But some people think that they will find bliss or happiness through power, through money, through even a mafioso thinks to find happiness by revenge, by all sorts of evil means. And yes, people suffer because they go the wrong way. But sooner or later, and I must say, without the law of reincarnation, you can't possibly hope for anything. But you come back again and again and again. It may take one lifetime even to overcome one strong habit that is destroying you, like alcoholism. It takes many, many lifetimes. Finally, to get it all right and understood. And this is the direction I want to go. This is the direction that will help me to find what I'm looking for. When I met Yogananda, I knew. The first words I addressed to him were, I want to be your disciple. And I have never changed that in all these years, over 62 years. I've always felt I want to be his disciple. And that saying, I want to be, is because I can't dare call myself his disciple. I'm just trying. But to be truly his disciple is to become like him. And I'm trying to become like that because I've seen that in him, in his least little gesture, his least smile, his least movement, in the tone of his voice, in so many little ways, he taught how to be a true and complete human being. Ultimately, I have to say, perhaps it was complete humanity that made me love him so deeply. He was human in the sense of loving everybody, but he was human also in the sense of having a wonderful sense of humor. He could make you laugh till the tears came down your cheeks. And yet, at the same time, he could be very stern when he needed to be. He could be very wise when he wanted to be. He was everything. My life has been based on trying to become like him. Not in the sense of imitating his tone of voice, but to developing that consciousness. I'm still on that path. I'm still working at it. But I'll have to say this, it's well worth it. Every step of the way has been a fulfillment. Well, you know, I'm not supposed to talk too long. I feel like talking forever. But I'm supposed to talk until 2 minutes ago. And then I'm supposed to give you a chance to ask your questions. So, all right, let me just ask you. Any questions? Yes. And Jyotish, you have to come here. I'm deaf as a post. So, another disadvantage of old age. Okay.
Throughout his life, he's been plagued with bad temper.
Okay. And lately, I mean, I've had it more under control in my life. But I've been having a lot of dreams where I've been very, very angry about something, and just like an everyday situation. And I'm just wondering what that means, if anything.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. The first thing to understand about temper is that it doesn't work. It's impractical. I know they tell people, as office managers, for example, don't be too peaceful. Try to get people to feel that you're in authority. Slam the door sometimes. Shout at people. I absolutely disagree. I think that's absolute bilge. If you are kind to people, they will be kind to you. I have thousands of people who listen to me and do what I say. Because I say it kindly, because I say it with their interests in mind. One of the rules that has made Ananda work has been that people are more important than things or projects or anything. And many times I've had something that I felt was very important for us to do, but because I couldn't find somebody who would be helped in doing it, I've abandoned the project. I feel people are the first thing. And any manager who thinks that way, he will have a team of people not quivering and quivering and shaking their boots before him, but eager to do what he wants. Because they know that he wants what is good for them. Anger comes when you have a desire and something goes against that desire. Give up the desire. Realize that life will go on anyway. Is it worth getting ulcers over this? It isn't. Is it worth getting angry just because things don't go your way? What right have you to expect them to go your way? Things will be as they are. And I would say that I don't think that I can remember getting angry. Yes, I can remember one time. It was about 40 years ago. Somebody had worked on my stove and left it open. So that when I came back and tried to light it, there was oil all over the floor. And I thought, he should know better than that. And I was absolutely furious. That was about the last time I ever got angry. It's just not worth it. Wasn't even worth it then. And I think that if you will get rid of your desires, if you'll just say, what if this actually happens? This is what I do. What if it should happen? Is it all that important? No, it's not that important. Learn, I would say, above everything else, to have a sense of humor. Life, after all, can be quite a lot of fun. If you see people, I mean, they don't all behave the way they ought to, but there is a certain comedy in it too, isn't there? I think God has a good sense of humor. And I think that's a part of what we're talking about here. So I hope that addresses your question. What's he saying?
Why does he keep having the dreams where he's very angry?
Yeah, but the dreams will go. The dreams will go when you... I know what you mean, but learn in your own heart. Your dreams are only a reflection of your own subconscious, and your subconscious will change gradually as you change. So don't worry about that. Just say, ho-hum, another one. Okay, any other questions? Yes.
Did your decision to go meet Yogananda and live there?
My mother was absolutely shocked. I mean, she'd been brought up a good Episcopalian, and she was horrified at first. There she was stuck in Cairo, and I was off in Los Angeles. And what was she to do in Cairo? You couldn't hop on a plane in those days. This is 1948. It was very difficult to do, at least. But she finally came to appreciate it very much. And I know she was very proud of me. But you have to. Jesus Christ said, he who is worthy of me must be willing to leave father, mother, brother, sister, everyone for my sake. If you want God, you have to make sacrifices. But what you will find is that he will give you, yes, a hundredfold and persecution. You can't avoid that. God has to make sure that you really do want him above everything. One time, Saint Teresa of Avila, she was a great Spanish saint, and she had a lot of trouble in her life with sickness and pain and persecution and all sorts of things. And towards the end of her life, she was going on a horse across on a journey to start a new monastery. And she suddenly, they were crossing a river which was in spate, and her horse lost its foot, and she was swept away by the current. And her nuns thought, "Oh, she's drowned now." Suddenly she found herself on the opposite bank, and Jesus was standing there. And Jesus said, "Don't feel too badly, Teresa. This is how I treat all my friends." And she had a great sense of humor. She said, "Ah, my Lord, no wonder you have so few." So... know that, yes, he will give you persecution. He will send you tests. You can't find him without being tested in the fire. But is it worth it? Absolutely. It's worth all the misunderstandings. And I've had to go through very intense pains in my life. And they haven't seemed fair sometimes, but there it is. People misunderstand your motives. They give you great pain. But I have noticed this one thing, that the greatest tests, if I accepted them, or let me say once I had accepted them, because they weren't always easy to accept, But once I had accepted them, I found they were my greatest blessings. God certainly will put you through the fire, but you will see that every time, if you do what you do to please Him and to do what is right by His will, you will see that you will come out in the end. And sometimes the end is death, but that end will bring you great, great bliss. I know my guru said to me once, God won't come to you until the end of life. Death itself is the final sacrifice you have to pay. These were his words to me, and I have to accept. I've had to work very hard to help spread his message. This has prevented me from having some of those blissful meditations you read about of hermits who go to mountaintops. But I know that I've done his will, and I feel that, yes, I may be martyred in the end. I think, so what? I mean, so you go up in fire even. What does it matter? God is always going to be there. You don't see the end of Joan of Arc's life. You see her body being consumed in flames. But the end is beyond this life. You never suffer. Death is not painful. It seems painful from outside. It is not painful because you don't feel that pain. All those martyrs in Christianity, they didn't feel the pain. As long as they had that faith in God, they didn't suffer. Their body suffered and they saw it even burning. It didn't matter to them. So this is a matter where faith comes in. Okay, it does. But if you look back through your life, you will see that everything that you've ever undergone has brought you a blessing far greater than you could ever have had if things had gone the way you wanted them to. So it's worth it. It's worth every moment of it. And there's nothing to feel but deep, deep gratitude. Okay? Yes? Any other questions? Yes.
I have to be careful and be quiet then. When you know what to do and fear gets in the way, what do you say to yourself? How do you work with yourself to stay strong in joy and do what you know to do for goodness and love and truth?
When you know what to do but fear gets in the way, how do you stay strong and be able to go with what you know you should do?
Fear is simply one of the temptations. You have to say that whether I'm afraid or not, I must go through it. Yeah. There have been times in my life when fear is not really a part of my nature, but I have feared to do wrong. I have feared to go against his will. But I have thought, am I to do nothing then? I must do what I see as right until he shows me that it's not right. I can't not act just because I have fear that I might act wrongly. I have found that always he has corrected any wrong direction I took and sent it in the right direction. We have to have that faith that he will be with us and he will guide us. Okay? Any other? Yes.
Yes. On the subject of prosperity, a number of master teachers see that as wealth is a right, an expression of one's self, and of course used wisely. My question is, do you see anything wrong with being spiritual and being very wealthy at the same time?
Being wealthy and spiritual?
Being wealthy and spiritual. Yeah. Is there anything wrong with that combination?
Many teachers or masters talk about our right to prosperity. Is there anything wrong with being wealthy and spiritual at the same time?
Nothing wrong. But I don't think we have a right to anything. As far as being wealthy, yes, you can do more with money if you have it than if you don't have it. And I would say that if you want to do good with the money you have, this is a great blessing. You get very good karma for it. But I myself feel that I'm rich if I have 5 cents in my pocket. So shall I give that away? I do. What does it matter? Wealth is just a thing. But if you seek wealth as of your own nature, for instance, Rajarshi, Yogananda's first disciple, he was a very wealthy man. When he was young, he earned about 13 cents a day. He had to work very hard, and he worked for prosperity, but he used that prosperity for other people. Everybody, the karmas that people go through in life are very complex. And some people, there was a beautiful story, I just was remembering it yesterday. A young man used to befriend an older man because he saw in this older man a lot of peace of mind, and he admired him for it. And he asked him one day, "What is the secret of your peace?" And the man said, "I'll tell you. Years ago, I was a very wealthy man. Then came the stock market crash in 1929. I lost everything. And suddenly, overnight, I found I had nothing. Many men have jumped out of buildings to kill themselves with that sudden shock. And I decided I too would kill myself. And I sent my family away and I took a little cabin by the ocean. And my plan was to go out into the ocean and let the water take me until I drowned. And I tried to get in and the waves kept pushing me back and throwing me onto my knees. And I couldn't do it. The waves were too strong. And one time I was getting up from my knees, and I saw, and he showed a little fragile shell. And I saw this little shell. It was intact, but it was so fragile I could have cracked it with my fingers. And he said, "How is it possible that this shell has taken all that pounding from all these swirling currents and yet remained intact?" I realized it was because it had gone with the currents, not against them. And so I took this shell and put it in a drawer and decided this would be my guideline in life. I would go with life's currents, not against them. I haven't remained poor. I never wanted to become wealthy again, but I've had what I needed. And the most important thing I have is peace of mind. Now, that's such a beautiful story because it tells us that there are many currents we have to go through in life. And some of them would seem, and some of them in my life have seemed, deliberately designed absolutely to destroy me. And yet I had to go through them. I had to go along with it. But I found in every case what had seemed the greatest curse was the greatest blessing. There was one point I was thrown out of my guru's organization. I was very heartbroken about this. It was a heartless thing to do. They left me in New York with only the money in my pocket. No help, no suggestion, only the sternest warning that if you have anything to do with any of our members, we will expose your countless treacheries, as they call them. They weren't treacheries. I'd done my very best to serve my guru. But they were out of jealousy, I think. They were determined that I was an absolutely evil man. I remember this one thing they said to me was, "You would stop at nothing short of murder to get what you want." I thought, what are they talking about? There was one time, in fact, as a complete contradiction of that, that I was trying to get some land in New Delhi, and there was a man, "Why don't you sit down so that you don't have this great weight off your knees?" And there was an ashram across the road which I knew about. It was a yoga ashram. I could have gotten land there. I wanted land in Delhi because I felt that's where I could serve my guru best. And I found that with a great miracle, I was able to get 1,700 societies that tried to get land there. Every one of them had been rejected. I was accepted. Nehru himself, the prime minister, walked around that land and said, yes, he should have it. And they were so upset with me at Mount Washington that they ended up throwing me out on my ear. And I have to say, I questioned, is my own guru abandoned me? And I said, even if you abandon me, I will not abandon you. Even if you reject me, you cannot get rid of me. I am yours, and you can't get rid of me. But I found in the end, it was the greatest blessing that came to me in my life. It made it possible for me to do all the things that I have done. And somebody asked me the other day, how have you been able to do them? I answered, by not doing them. That may sound strange, but I've written 140 books. I've written over 400 pieces of music. I've started eight communities. I've done all kinds of things, but I've done them because there was no stress involved. I wasn't doing them. He was doing them. And I found that by letting God be the doer, everything has turned out so beautifully. And you wouldn't be here, I wouldn't be here, if I hadn't just taken that one thing that they said, never do anything in the name of your guru again. I said, that is the one piece of advice I cannot accept. I was willing to obey them in anything, but I could not obey them in that. And with that one thought that I can't do nothing for my guru, I have to do something, he led me forward to the point where I was able to do so much. I've done it by not doing it. He did it through me. I ask for a melody that will say this, this, and this, and the melody's there. I don't have to worry about it. I wrote a book. I wrote the Bhagavad Gita commentaries in less than 2 months. Impossible. I don't know how I did it, but I did. I wrote a book called The Time Tunnel a few months ago, but this year. And it was a beautiful children's story, but it was all handed to me on a silver platter. I didn't know where it was going. It just went, and it went beautifully. And I wrote 180 pages in 2 weeks. This isn't normal. But it's become normal for me, because I find that if I ask God, he just gives it to me. I've had to work for that, yes, but it has come that way. You will see in your life that the more you hold out your hand and walk with God and don't think, well, I've got to do it. No, he's doing it. It's not that you sit back and let him do it all. You have to do your best, but remember Yogananda's prayer, I will reason, I will, I will act, but guide thou my reason, will, and activity to the right path in everything. And you'll find with his guidance, his inspiration will come. And with that inspiration, you'll know what to do. And it doesn't create strain or stress or anything. It just, life becomes beautiful that way. So, yes, you can try to become wealthy, but do think of other people and let that wealth be for others also. I remember I said once to my mother, she was seeing this beautiful estate, and I said, I can't imagine spending all that money on myself. And she said, well, that's a new way of looking at things. But indeed, that's how I feel. What would I want with it? Any other questions? Yes.
I heard you on Lisa Garr's show, and then I realized I had bought your autobiography of a Western yogi in 1979, so I got it out again. My question is, you said something about get land, because I think we're heading into, you know, more severe economic times, something along those lines. And so I wondered if your book on intentional communities is still available.
Better help me.
She was talking about your, she heard you on the radio, and she has the book, The Path. She was asking about the question of getting land and whether your book on cooperative communities is still available.
It is available, I hope. You're nodding, okay. I don't pay too much attention to that aspect of our work, but it is available. It's a very useful book. I seriously think we are on the verge of a very great depression. That's partly why I'm in Los Angeles, to help people to understand that things are not going to be so easy, even a year from now. And it could be, and I read this in a financial newspaper recently, that hyperinflation could occur within 24 hours. Hard to believe, but it's happened in at least twice in the last century, two or three times more, I believe, Argentina and Germany. In Germany, you could buy two sausages in the morning with the same amount of money, only one sausage in the afternoon. The money became worthless, and Master said repeatedly, and he warned people, he wasn't being negative, he was trying to help people to seek a positive solution. He said that money will not be worth the paper it's printed on. You could put it in gold, but you can't eat gold. I'd say the most important thing is buy land. And because very few people are all sufficient to themselves, most people need to do it with other people. I would urge you, either join Ananda, but I don't know how many people we can absorb, or get together with friends and buy land. Get land out in the country. It'll be the best investment you can have, because you can at least grow food on that land. Land is the true wealth now. We're coming to a time of serious suffering. And ask yourselves this question. How will trucks with food be able to reach the inner cities when they can't get through the outer cities because people are trying to get the food off those trucks themselves? Detroit, that happened recently, just a year ago. They were having some trouble there, and people bringing food into the inner cities had to have people with guns on each side of the truck in order to protect that food. Mind you, that's only a presage of what's to come. I'm quite serious when I say this. Please take it. Don't think that you have money because you have money in the bank. That money won't be worth anything. Get something where you can live, where you can grow your food, where you can be with people who could inspire you, and where you can do things that they can do things you can't do, you can do things they can't do. You get a group of people, and usually at Ananda, for example, we find anything that's needed. Somebody knows how to do it. I myself, if I went out there, had I become a hermit, I wouldn't know what to do. I wouldn't know how to grow food. I wouldn't know how to build a building. I wouldn't know how to do anything. I'm good with a pen. I'm not good with a hammer. I'll hit it a nail 10 times and miss it 9. And when I finally hit it, it bends like this. I'm a hopeless carpenter. But I have people who are good carpenters. And so we're able, with a group of people, to pool our different resources and accomplish. Please take my word seriously. One more question.
I heard you on the radio this past week, an interview in which you were talking about thinking of God in terms of one's higher self, your own higher self. However, today you were talking about God in the more traditional sense. And I wonder if you could discuss those two conceptions of God.
He heard you on the radio, and you were talking about thinking of God as our own higher self, but today you were talking about God more in the traditional sense of God.
Yes, you know, you need to have the feeling that you're talking to someone. Otherwise, you sort of feel yourself in a corner mumbling to yourself. So it does help to think of God as you. But in fact, it's all you. You are talking to yourself. God is your higher self. This is the final truth. But even saints like to come down from that level and play this I and thou relationship, because it's beautiful in a human way. There's a song, a story about a great saint, Ram Prasad, in Bengal. And he was out, he was married, he had a daughter and a wife, and he was fixing a fence. And his daughter came and played with him and teased him, and he said to him, "Daddy, who are you singing to?" And he said, "I'm singing to God, my divine mother." And she says, "But she's very naughty. I keep singing to her and she doesn't answer." And the little girl said, "Well, if she doesn't answer, why do you bother?" And she laughed and ran away. And he later in the day came back into the house and told his wife about how the daughter had come and so on. She said, "No, our daughter couldn't be there. She's on the other side of town today, don't you remember?" And then he realized that it was the Divine Mother herself playing that game with him. Well, this sort of play of God and his devotees, it's so much more beautiful than thinking just I. That's a little dry. So if you know that it is your own higher self, philosophically, we have to speak one way. Devotionally, we have to speak another. My way was the philosophical way, the intellectual way. But I have to say, this other way is much more satisfying. Okay? Thank you all for coming. It's been a joy.